Well, good morning. There we go. Yeah, there's sound in the house. Good morning. We're going to get started here in a few minutes because, well, I only have 180 slides to go through. So, you know, well, I'll take a zero off of that. We'll roll it back to 18. Yeah, it's great to hear everybody just having great conversations around. And this morning, my intention is to have a little fun. My idea of fun's different than everybody else's. But there should be a little history, a little age of interest, should be for all ages, and then a little bit of mystery. So, Where God Came Down is a title of a great book. And I'm not endorsing the author. Yeah, I am endorsing the author. But he hasn't given me any books. But I bought two, and I think they're great. Reason why I think they're great, it's probably some of the best pictures, aerial photography, out of the Holy Land. And he's an archaeologist. He's lived in the Middle East most of his life. He speaks some Hebrew. He speaks a lot of Farsi, which is the Arabic language, and he knows the area. But he's an archaeologist, but he calls himself a biblical archaeologist. So he's not looking at things from what's in this dark hole. He's looking at it from the perspective, what do we find out from the ancient text? And his ancient text he always goes to is the Bible. So if you're looking for a book, nice pictures, very interesting reading, lots of history in a simplified format, and a very thin book, this is one to really to look at. So that's where I gained my title from. So this book, he uses the funding out of this book to do more videos. Now, he's a YouTube video person, so he's got lots of them out there. If you want to look him up, Joel P. Kramer is his name. And he's just very interesting. He just takes a look at a lot of things from a biblical perspective, tries to tie it all back, and does it well. I mean, he's got viewpoints that, yeah, we're not going to agree with everybody 100%, so we'll get that out of the way. But for him, he's going to look back at the biblical text and see what it has to say. So in this book, he's got 10 places that he talks about where God came down and met people. And I'm just going to go through this list because this is the last time I talk about this and the book itself, because we're going to hit a topic that adds to this list, so to speak. So one of the places the title of it is The Place of Promise. Now, this is the promise of Abraham. Remember, Abraham was sent from Haran out in the north to go to a place, which I'll show you, comes down, he's got flocks, he's got everything. He's got his whole household with him, he's got his son Lot. But there's a place of promise where, you remember the story with Abram and Sarai. They're going to have an heir. She's what, 80? He's like 90? And they wait another 10 years for that promise to take place. So anyway, there is a place associated with that. And that's at Mamre. Mountain of God, the Mount Moriah. So we know the Mount Moriah story. We've got the sacrifice that's going to take place, you know, of Jacob, right? Slowing up of my thought process, but that mountain where God provides the ram as opposed to a human sacrifice and all the symbolism that goes there, that's Temple Mount area. And from an archaeological perspective, why Joel is looking at this is because he's looking at some place that has something built one upon the other, rune upon rune, have a history behind it. And Mount Moriah is that. Now, many archaeologists would love to go on Mount Moriah and start digging, right? First shovel load's going to cause a war. And we got a war over there right now, which is ending. Thankfully that we've got some calmer minds helping out that. But if a Jew starts digging on Temple Mount right now, that's war. Now, the Muslims, the mullahs, a couple of years ago, started digging and hauling truckloads of stuff out of there and dumping it over the edge of a cliff. That was okay. What that gave was the Israeli archaeologists a source of the Temple Mount, and they've been sifting through that stuff for years and finding amazing things. But why is this important in this book? Because this is where God came down. God came down and met a man and talked to him. Gate of Heaven, that's Abraham's camp. Now, what's neat about this one is in this one, we can go to the scripture, but it talks about a place between Bethel and Ai. And Ai is that town, that second town when the children of Israel came into the land and they got destroyed. Nothing's been built there. So there's a biblical reference. So if you're going to go look for where God came down at the Abraham camp, you start, pull out a map and look at it. And that's how that site was actually found. Shepherd's Cave. This is the one where Abraham bought a cave to bury his wife, right? Another place shared by Jews and Arabs today. And no one's been down in those caves in almost 100 years. Once again, somebody wants to go looking around in there and sifting through and finding something that it could start a war. And that's just very, very dangerous. And the last of the Old Testament, the Covenant City. This is the city of David. This is, you have Mount Moriah on the hill, and downslope is the city of David. Lots of archaeological digging there. All right, I'm going to rapidly go through the New Testament side. Some of these are important to us, some of these are not important, but what is important is the fact that early times, I'm talking years after Christ left to go back to heaven, to the Father's side, these sites became really important. House of the Virgin or House of the Annunciation, they've dug that up, they've gone through layers of things, it's layer upon layer. It starts out as Jewish converts to following Christ. And there's a layer. And then there's somebody else that invades. They destroy that, and another layer on top of it. And there's layer upon layer in archaeology. And these places have been dug, and they look up them. The sacred cave in Bethlehem, that's Church of the Nativity today. The garden. Now, the garden is a little bit controversial because we have one garden and then there's a garden that has one thing built upon another, lots of churches. And that's where Joel believes that the garden was, the Garden of Gethsemane, the place where Christ was crucified, the place where he's buried. And he has his reasons for believing what he believes. The high place, Mount of Olives, I never thought about it much. You know, Mount of Olives is some really future things going to happen, but there's also some other things that happened there. Once again, it's a high place. It's one thing built upon another. One of the things that gets talked about in archaeology a lot is the fact that there are known authors, Eusebius and some others, that are writing in the 120s and the 200s and the 300s, and they're talking about the followers of Jesus in churches, the first church, and these are places that are important for archaeology and for proving the scripture, right? Proving the Bible. What I say proving the Bible, I think most of us can agree we believe the Bible and it has its own proof, right? But we can validate archaeology with the Bible. And in turn, it provides that reference back to Scripture. Scripture is true because we found something in the physical world that relates to that. All right, I'm going to move on. So my point, or the topic I'm going to focus on today is Jericho. So Jericho has a couple of archaeological issues with it that we'll hit the highlights of. That's the intrigue that we're looking for here. If you go to Jericho today, about 1%, and some estimate 2% of the city has been dug. So it's like you and I going out into the next lot that's been rehashed and redug, and 2 years or a year ago there was a big hole there, and you go out there and you take a shovel and you dig a hole in the ground and you find a rock. Now you're trying to figure out why that rock is significant because it looks like all different from everything else that's around it. Well, that's what archaeology is. You're trying to look at a place, you dig a small little piece out of it, and they're trying to assess, an archaeologist is trying to assess what was significant about this site. Now, archaeologists, once they go dig there, they've got an opinion, and they want to share it with everybody. Now, the current opinion in Jericho is, first thing I want to say is 95% of the visitors that go to Jericho today are Christian. They're Christian focused. Now, you'll see a few other groups. You'll see lots of Asians come through, but Christian-based Asians, meaning they believe in Jesus. And the fact that no Israeli Jew can go there because it's in the West Bank and it's illegal under the current Israeli law, under current West Bank law, that no Israeli Jew can go visit the site. Now, this is a significant site. I mean, this is something that has a lot of scripture behind it, but they can't visit. You and I, we can go visit. Now, if we go there, it's acknowledged that it's one of the oldest cities in that area. So it's got a lot of history, many archaeologists, many stories, many texts validate this. But if you go there today, you're going to see placards, and it's going to describe what you're seeing. And you get this free brochure, and it tells you all about what you're going to be seeing. And it's telling you that the story of Jericho is not biblical. There's no evidence for it. And the story that you've been taught from a young age, that most of our kids can tell you about, the sing the song of Jericho walls falling down, that's a nice story and a myth. So, that becomes disturbing to me. I've been there, I've looked at it, and I've seen my things, and so, but this is the story that's currently being told. And we're going to ask the question, why, now, and answer it later. But you and I, biblical believers, if we found one solid piece of evidence that related back to the Bible, would you and I agree that that was probably Jericho? Except for our friend Charles yesterday. He's going to want two. Which I'm okay with, because we could probably find two pieces of solid evidence that Jericho is the story. And I tease Charles. I don't share that with him. I don't see him here now, but him and I will talk about this. So that's where we're going to go. So since this is a Bible study, we should probably hit a Bible scripture or two. We're going to start out in Joshua 3 here. We're talking about the time Joshua has now inherited the role of leader. Moses is past his season of leading. This is the children of Israel. And they're ready to cross the Jordan. So we're going to start Joshua 3, verse 15. It was the harvest season, and the Jordan was overflowing its banks. As soon as the feet of the priests who were carrying the ark touched the water at the river's edge, the water above that point began backing up a great distance away from the town called Adam, which is near Zaranath. And the water below that point flowed onto the Dead Sea until the riverbed was dry and all the people crossed over the town. Now, there's a couple of extraordinary things we want to pick up here. Water was overflowing the banks. This miracle took place, right? That's a good one. And the water downstream seemed to go away, and they crossed it dry. All right, so continue on in Joshua 5. Now, I'm skipping parts of the story due to time, right? I could talk about this longer, but we got only a certain amount of time. So we're taking highlights. Joshua 5, verse 10. While the Israelites were camped at Gilgal on the plains of Jericho, they celebrated Passover on the evening of the 14th day of the first month. We've got a referenced date on the calendar that we can think about. The very next day, they began to eat unleavened bread and roasted grain harvested from the land. They're invaders at this point, right? But they harvested grain from the land. No manna appeared on that day. They first ate from the crops of the land, and it was never seen again. So from that time on, the Israelites ate from the crops of Canaan. So they found grain in the land at the time of Passover. key pieces. All right. Now, when Joshua was near the town, and this is Joshua 5, following on verse 13, Joshua was near the town of Jericho. He looked up and saw a man standing in front of him with a sword in his hand. Joshua went up to him and demanded, "Are you friend or foe?" It's a bold move. "Neither one," is the reply. "I am the commander of the Lord's army. This is why Jericho's significant to me." My opinion, and others, God came down, met Joshua before a super significant event. He's looking. I mean, if you're going to be an army of people, that's great, and you're going to go in and you're going to conquer a land, wouldn't you like to have a good word that you're doing the right thing from God? And so I believe this is Joshua's personal encounter with God in an intimate way in this place. And so a lot of my opinion here, but I think it's important. At this, Joshua fell on his face to the ground in reverence. "I am at your command," Joshua says. "What do you want your servant to do?" So Joshua's the leading invader, and he's got somebody important in front of him, and he's going to acknowledge that. This is significant. And the commander of the Lord's army replied, "Take off your sandals, for the place where you're standing is holy." And Joshua did as he was told. One significant point in time before that somebody was told to take off their sandals was when, who? Moses, right? Burning bush. Significant event. Meeting, God meets with his leaders at significant times. All right. Moving on to Joshua 6. On the seventh day. So a lot of story we're skipping over, but we've got the history here. We can do this. On the seventh day, the Israelites got up at dawn, marched around the town as they did before, but this time they went around the town seven times. And the seventh time, as the priest sounded the long blast on their horns, Joshua commanded the people, "Shout, for the Lord has given you the town. Jericho and everything in it must be completely destroyed as an offering to the Lord. Only Rahab, the prostitute, and the others in her house will be spared, for she protected the spies. Do not take," and this is Joshua speaking, "do not take any of the things set apart for the destruction, or you yourselves will be completely destroyed, and you will bring trouble on the camp of Israel. Everything made from gold, silver, bronze, or iron is sacred to the Lord and must be brought into the treasury." So they've got their orders. They know what they're supposed to be doing. "And when the people heard the sound of the ram's horn, they shouted as loud as they could. Suddenly the walls of Jericho collapsed, and the Israelites charged straight into the town it captured." The word collapsed here, I've got it underlined. It has a significant meaning for me when I look back into the definitions. The walls collapsed. The statement here meaning they fell in unto themselves. Well, that's significant. If you got an earthquake, things fall down and scatter all around. But the walls here fell into themselves. Interesting statement. Next statement that's really interesting is the Israelites charged straight into the town and captured it. Now, the walls came tumbling down. You got walls that fell into themselves, and the word here when they say charged straight is actually they charged up into the city. That's one of the definitions of the Hebrew words. So two significant things here we want to keep in mind as we move forward. Now, they completely destroyed everything with their swords. Now, Dave, I'm sorry, this is the verse that's got me a little bit misunderstanding, and we'll have to have a conversation with our father at some point in time to have him explain it to us. But the men, they destroyed everything with their swords. Men, women, young, old, cattle, sheep, goats, and donkeys. There's nothing alive after this. But that's a tough point. That is a tough point. And we'll move on. "Then the Israelites burned the town and everything in it, Only the things made of gold, silver, gold, bronze, iron were kept for the treasury of the Lord's house. All right. So, there's other parts of the story we know that we're not going to talk about this time, but for now we're going to continue on in Joshua 6 and verse 26. At that time, Joshua invoked a curse. So Joshua met with the Lord, or Father in heaven, or representative of heaven, however we're going to choose to describe him. Got his marching orders, got very specific words, but Joshua gave this, invoked this curse. May the curse of the Lord fall upon anyone who tries to rebuild the town of Jericho at the cost of his firstborn son. He will lay its foundations. At the cost of his youngest son, he will set up its gates. So the Lord was with Joshua, and his reputation spread throughout the land. So that's this portion here, the focus is the curse. Jericho is not going to be a town. Now, you go there today, there's a town. It's beside a ruin. But there were people through history that tried to build there, and they had trouble. In this case, it says you're going to lose your firstborn son for setting a foundation, foundation stones, the base layer. And if you put a gate up, you're going to lose your youngest son. So you're wiping out your whole descendants, is really what the curse is stating here. Serious, serious business. Now, either you believe Joshua or you don't, but history says Joshua's curse stood. All right. So, we've got a season of the year we talked about in the calendar-wise. We talked, because it was Passover season. They ate out of the fields that they saw. But when did this happen? Year. I mean, there's got to be something that ties that together. And we're going to use the reference from 1 Kings 6. And I'll read it, and then we'll hit the bullet points of my statements below. So in 1 Kings 6:1, it was in mid-spring, the month of Ziv, during the fourth year of Solomon's reign, that he began to construct the temple of the Lord. This was 480 years after the people of Israel were rescued from slavery in the land of Egypt. Now, among many scholars, using math, using tablets out of Nineveh, estimate and feel very comfortable with this date of 967 BC as when Solomon started building the temple. Don't have time to go into it. It's really, really interesting if you want to study it out, because there's great documents and videos that talk about that. But we're just going to have to make an assumption for this conversation about 967 being the beginning of Solomon's temple. All right, so we've got a date now. Now, the beginning of, so that we know the beginning. And we know Solomon's temple construction beginning is 467. We know that 480 BC had, or 480 years, I got BC in there and I read it, 480 years previous to that, they left Egypt. Now, if we subtract 40 years from that for the time they wandered in the wilderness, that brings the story of Jericho to approximately 1407 BC. For our conversation points right now, just keep 1400 in mind. So now we have a year and a season that we're looking into, which will be significant as we move forward. All right. So there were people that were wondering. At the 1800s, they started really going into the Middle East and started, hey, let's dig here, let's dig there. This was the end of the Ottoman Empire. Ottoman Empire ended roughly around the time of World War I, right? So they ruled for 1,000 years, approximately. Significant time of rule, but there wasn't much emphasis in this desert land in the Middle East. But people who were biblical people, biblical scholars, were interested in it. There must be places over there. I mean, they've been making pilgrimages through the land since the time of Christ on earth here. But two significant people set up an excavation group. And they went in 1907 and 1909, Ernst Sellen and Carl Waltzinger. And they determined that the site they were looking at was Jericho. And their reference script, or their reference documentation, was the Bible. They used that. They felt pretty, they went and dug around, they found things. Hey, this is a city. We found some things that line up here. That's great. So another gentleman, about 1930, and he dug for about approximately 6 years, John Garstang, he confirmed that the city that Sellen and Waltzinger looked at was actually Jericho. And he said, I'm going to go back to Scripture, and I'm going to find the stuff that's in Scripture and see if it's at this site, because they said it was Jericho. I'm going to have to prove it's Jericho. And so he starts digging, and he finds stuff. So what did he find? And then there's I won't say last, but there's another significant work in digging by Kathleen Kenyon, 1952 to 1958, another six-year period. She had a different reference point. She was a declared atheist, and she said, now, the city is Jericho. Yeah, I agree with that. It's Jericho, but that Joshua myth story, that's a myth. It happened, and she goes, those dates don't line up. But this created what is commonly called the Jericho controversy. So we got our mystery now. So now you've got two major groups that said, yeah, this is a Bible-based thing we found. We've got evidence for it. And somebody else came along and said, nah, it's not the case. All right. So some of the things that John Garstang found, let's start there. So Jericho was a double-walled city. He confirmed it. He found two circular walls around the city. What he found in the outer wall was really interesting. It was a 25-foot stone wall. So the center room over here is the best example. Think 25 feet up to the kind of a roof line there. Stone wall. And he found evidence that there was a 25-foot red brick wall on top of that. Very interesting. He uses the word red brick because he found red brick. And we find in Scripture that there's a wall. All right. Now, what he did find when he was looking, that the red brick wall had collapsed. And he used the word collapsed. He found rooms full of jars of burnt grain. And he found a layer of ash above that. It was about 3 foot thick, where a city had been burned. And he found some other things which are key, because he was a pottery expert of Middle Eastern pottery. And archaeologists use pottery for dating. So the best example we have is slang English. From 1920s, you have words that don't mean the same thing today, right? So language changes slowly but gently over time. Well, it's the same thing with pottery. You have people making pots, but the styling changes over time. Now, John Garstang studied pottery from many, many sites. Oh, he did a lot of digging, and he was expert knowledge in that area. And many, many people agreed. They said, yes, your dating method is accurate, and we agree with the dates you're putting on pottery, and that's used still today as a guide. I mean, that's how thorough he was in his research. Now, one of the things that's significant that we want to just mention at this point, because it'll become important in a moment, is he also found pottery that was a replica of Cypriot-style pottery dating. That's how he dated the city. He dated the city. He says, the layer under the ash has replica pottery of the Cyprian style, and it dates to 1400, because he's got other references from other dig sites that says they track back time. So that's how he comes up with the city collapsed around 1400 because of the styling of pottery. So now he's got some evidence. He's packed together, he pieced together. He's really confident that he's got himself a city. And the grain that they found, it wasn't one jar of grain. It was storerooms of jars after jars full of grain that was burnt because there was an ash layer above it. And all the grain, when they opened the jars, they could see wrecked jars, they could see whole jars, but when they opened a jar, it was burnt. Significant. If you're an archaeologist and you're reading scripture and you're trying to see if things line up, that's a significant point. All right. Now, some of the items that were that are confirmed by Kathleen Kenyon. Now, granted, she says she's an admitted atheist and says this Jericho story is a myth. But she's a really, really significant archaeologist. She developed the bulk theory of archaeology. It's where you go in, you determine a square. You look at the ground, you find pottery there. You'll find old pottery on top of the ground, and that's how you determine where you want to dig. And so she determined that you dig a square down, a set square, and try to keep them consistent. You can dig many places, several places, and she dug five squares. And then she goes in and reads the stratification layers, what's here. And so she confirmed what Selin Waltzinger and John Garstang found. We've got ourselves a city. It had two walls. There was burnt grain. There was an ash layer. And above the ash layer was what they call an abandonment layer. You and I call it erosion. Stuff from up on the hill washes down the hill and covers things up. But that's the destruction, or that's the layer, and she confirms it. She says, it's here. And she dug around some more and said, you know, there's no Cypriot pottery here that we're looking for. None. Not John Garstang's got pottery in a museum. But she says, there's no Cypriot pottery here. Everything I see puts this city at 1550 BC. Now, why is that significant to our story? Well, if the walls fell down in 1550 BC, Joshua's got no city to run up into and invade. So therefore, the Joshua story is just a myth. And there'd be no city here for him, so sorry. And she's so convinced she publishes it. Now her team, a majority of her team were atheists also. There was a gentleman, his name, he was a dig superintendent, dig director under her for most of the years that she was there. I think the first year he wasn't, but the rest of the years. He was, in 2008, Joel Kramer brought him back to Israel. He's 93 years old. And so they go back to Jericho. They start talking about things, right? And they, you know, and he's the last person alive that they could talk to. And they had real interesting conversations, you know. Joel asks him, he goes, well, what about the Jericho story? We've looked at all this evidence. And he goes, well, what story are you talking about? No reference point to Scripture. Because growing up as an atheist, the Bible's not relevant. Family probably never taught him the Sunday school song about the Jericho walls falling down. He goes, really? And so they start talking back and forth with him a little bit about it. And he goes, there's room in here for a possible error. He's willing to admit that. And he goes, we can talk some more. So that's a separate conversation, but it was an interesting conversation from somebody of the original dig that Kathleen Kenyon had worked. All right, so what do we know? Let's go back to today. Jordan River, spring flood, 1950s. The river was over a mile wide near Jericho. The River Jordan flood stage. Now it'll never flood, right? Because there's so many water diversion projects and that sort of thing. But in the 1950s, the Jordan River was a river. And they scooped water out of it as opposed to diverted it for a lot of irrigation. But think of it. At flood stage, it's a mile wide at Jericho. Now, if you're the children of Israel going to cross over and you see a mile-wide river in front of you, you're going to need a miracle to cross that, right? So that's important. Or that's significant, let's say. And defeating a city, now they went in and to defeat the city, but they remember we found jars and jars of burnt grain. So the city had harvested the fields. That is the worst time if you're going to try to invade a city. Because they can sit behind their city with a spring and some grain, and they can live for years. So you and I, as planners, would not go try to invade that city. All right, so when John Garstang found grain in jars, and everybody agreed it was grain, and everybody assumed it was wheat. Recent genetic testing, it's barley. Spring harvest. Time of year now, it's confirmed. That's significant. All right, what about this red brick wall that fell? Well, when it fell in unto itself, it's the only site found to this date in the Middle East, and it's expanded out. Go from the Nile, let's say, to the Euphrates and everything in between. And there are loads of earthquakes. But they haven't found a city collapse in into itself where the walls fell outward all the way around it. Very unique. They also, even Peter Parr said, this is extremely unique. It's nowhere else. I've done 12 sites in the Middle East. Earthquake has its pattern. This fell outward. So we got that fell in outward. And it produced a ramp, right? So if you're going to run up into the city, remember, we're trying to invade a city of a wall, stone wall, and you got to get up that 25-foot incline. How are you going to do that? Well, if the top wall fell off the side, you've got a ramp, and you just run up into the city and invade. So the other piece that's really, really significant, I talked about it more, the abandonment layer. I mean, we're talking in some places, you know, it's 3 or 4 feet, right? Okay, so you've got erosion that happens over 100 years, right? But in other places, 50, 60 feet, right? And there's this huge depth of it. They would go through that abandonment layer. There was nobody. I mean, they may find a campsite remains, but they didn't find any building around that. They also found a section of wall that didn't collapse. Huh. So you have people now going, well, that kind of matches up with Scripture, right? That's an important thing. So these key pieces of what we know are starting to now line up as evidence. So in my little whiteboard description here, I'm going to ask Ben to switch me over to the tablet for just a moment. I'm visual, so I wanted to do a little graphics here. So if you're coming up to Jericho, and there's a mound, right? So we're coming along, and it's fairly flat to the east of Jericho, but today there's a mound. And roughly that's what it's going to look like. Also at that time when the children of Israel came across, because cities were built at a higher place. They would find a reason or a way to build it a little bit higher. So we have this hill here, this mound, and we're going to dig that. So if we dig down, and I'm going to get my eraser out, so we're going to dig this little section here, and we're going to dig down. Pen back. And so we're going to dig ourselves a little square. We're going to go down. And we're going to try to find something. And when you dig down, now you got your area. This is Kathleen Kinney in her style. She's going to dig a square. She's going to study the layers. So she sees a layer here and a layer there. And there's different things that they find. But in over here, they find themselves a stone wall. And, oops, I got the eraser going, don't I? Well, anyway, we're going to have to, for the sake of time, we're going to say we found ourselves a stone wall. And around the entire perimeter, they found themselves a layer of red brick. There today. Go see it. Go look for it. Find it for yourself. So they found this wall, but they were digging out this rubble over here. And what did they find? They found, if you touch the side of this, it erases. They find this layer of red brick. So somebody else comes along and says, well, you know, that could be a coincidence, right? So let's dig out here a little bit farther. And they found a whole ramp of red brick. They're there today. Now, That's significant because it does validate a couple of our assumptions that we were talking about just a few minutes ago. We need to get into this city. There's a ramp there. There's a way to get in, right? The walls fell down. We got to climb over something. So now there's this ramp, and you can actually get into the city. So that's there today. You can go over there and see it. The current archaeologist that was there a few years ago, he was filling in some of these places, and some of this evidence was going away because he was reburying it. But there's enough pictures that we can say, yep, that's what's going on here. But there's red brick. Now this isn't out of any archaeological report or anything like that. I'm doing this for artistic license purposes. What they did find is they did find jars at a layer. Oops, I need a black pen for this because they found jars at a layer. And it was jar after jar after jar. And above that, they found a gray. Let's see, I got gray here. This is awesome. They found a gray, oh, it's going to be black. It's going to be gray ash layer above it. So everything that was burnt fell down on it. So they found that. And it's there. And these three archaeology teams agree on this. This is something they all agree on. The only thing that they didn't really agree on was a piece of pottery. And in the Kathleen Kenyon's report, it states, because of the absence of Cypriot pottery, we claim that the story is a myth. This is Jericho, but it has no relevance to the Joshua story. So an absence of evidence is used as proof. And just about every archaeologist, including Peter Parr, one of her assistants, said, that's dangerous, right? That's a dangerous premise to work from, is the absence of evidence. And so you and I now have to make a decision. We have to have a little bit of a decision. I can switch back to my last slide. What did we find? Okay. So, yeah, Sullen and Waltzinger, we confirmed that the site was Jericho. John Garstang used the Bible as the ancient text to understand what he found at the site. Kathleen Kenyon refused to use the Bible to understand the context of Jericho. Think back, 1930s dig by John Garstang and Kathleen Kenyon in the 1950s. What significant date or event happened between those two digs? Any guess? It's easy. It's not a hard quiz. World War II. More importantly, after World War II. Yes. Creation of Israel, 1948. So, John Garstang's going over there. He's funded. Gets his funding. He says, I'm going to go look for a Bible thing. Got all kinds of money. Went there. Kathleen Kenyon, famous archaeologist, well-renowned, well-written, is found permitting and approvals and funding source from the university in Jordan. Now, where's their influence? Remember, 1948, we have the West Bank, we have the partitioned area. There's supposed to be two countries, right? Israel gets a wedge, and the Palestinians get everything else. I'm exaggerating. But it's the concept. And she's being funded or directed by somebody who's very, very interested in a Palestinian home state. Because remember, Jordan doesn't want any more Palestinians in their country. They already have many camps with lots of them. They don't want any more Palestinians. So Palestinians need a homeland. So the West Bank is a predominant area. And Kathleen Kenyon is an atheist, so she's got no biblical reference to work from, and she's choosing to make her decisions on her plan. Money will impact people, we know that, and you know, I'm not judging her for it, I'm just stating that it's really interesting that the two dates of the two major digs, significant area, two different conclusions, causes controversy. And today, there is a controversy about it. It's what do you choose to believe? What are the evidence points you are going to look at? Now, to Charles' point, you know, we need at least two reference points or two witnesses out of this. I've provided you, hopefully, with ample evidence. Red brick wall that fell down. Barley in burnt jars. That's, for me, that's really significant. When you're not looking for it, but that's what you find, you go back to Scripture and find out that there's burnt barley in the jars. That's significant. The city that was abandoned and never rebuilt. Well, never significantly rebuilt, right? The city of Jericho that's around it, big city. The mound itself, they've actually excavated 1% to 2% of it. There's a lot left to excavate, a lot more to find. But the point being, we've got enough evidence for us to consider, hey, the walls did fall down in Jericho. The children's story is probably true. We know the Bible's true, and we found things from the Scripture. So we have to make our own decision. There's others out there who are fighting, who are being influenced to fight against that. But that's the world we live in today. We choose based on truth. Anyway, that's my presentation. Would love any hear any comments that anybody would offer up. If not, oh, we got, Dennis will always bail me out.
I was just wondering, you know, they have the evidence of the pottery. Was there evidence of jewelry or human remains? I mean, because jewelry kind of styles change too.
They found lots of bones. The jewelry, they've not found any significant gold, silver, bronze, iron. It was picked up. It's noticeably absent in the digs. I mean, they just don't find it. You find clay pottery, lots of that, lots of different styles, but the metals, no, that they were carted off. Into the treasury, we believe. Yes. Any other comments? All right. Oh, we got one more. Charles, yes.
Yeah, I can't remember the exact saying, but it's something to the effect of, if history contradicts the Bible, then it's false history. So, you know, the Bible has a final say. We know who inspired what was written. So I wasn't here earlier.
Oh, I quoted you earlier. I said that if we found one solid piece of evidence, we would consider the Bible true. But, you know, you offered up, maybe we need two. So I took two. All right. Yeah. Thank you, Charles.
Good job. You should be speaking more often.
We'll see. Yes, please.
So you've been over there during the spring kind of barley harvest time, is that right?
I haven't been there in springtime. I've been there just before that. So okay.
Well, I was just curious, like, so, you know, you have the first of the first fruits,
right,
barley harvest during unleavened bread. Is there really a large, I mean, I don't know how agricultural works, but I mean, is the first harvest of it, of the barley, is it really quick and sudden like that? Like, I mean, I was always thinking it would be like, you know, a small amount and then the rest would be all the way up until Pentecost.
So friends of mine that have gone there, I'm going to use this as my reference point because I didn't physically see it for myself, but I know it to be true. Barley is a very, very interesting grain in that when it ripens, you have days and it'll fall off the head. So it time is extremely important. If you don't harvest it in time, you don't get a crop. That's the real interesting thing. And barley is a grain that's, you know, it takes very light crushing. I mean, you're not really crushing it. You're when you sift it, and it's very, very light. What's interesting about wheat in the Pentecost time of the year, when the wheat harvest is, it's a hard, much harder grain, and you have to crush it more, and it stays on the stalk. So there are pictures in one of the videos, because Joel was there in that area during the spring barley harvest, and they're out there, the heads are full, and they're just cutting it with a scythe, loading it onto donkeys, and taking, and he says they're out there diligently harvesting because it's literally days that it stays on, once it's ripe, that it stays on the stalk. Anyone else? Oh, Charles, one more time.
I don't know much about barley, but I know we wouldn't have beer without it.
Did they have beer in Jericho and places like that?
You know, that's an interesting question. Jars of beer, you know, they didn't say anything about that in any of the reports. That would be interesting. All right, well, we got 8 minutes before service, so let's just adjourn there. Thanks for everybody for listening. I really appreciate it.